these microphones in Superior, so we'll see if I can figure this out. There we go. If you have a Bible and you want to turn to Isaiah, we will start in the book of Isaiah. It's good to be here. It's been a while since I've been at Campus Church, so it is nice to come and join you. With that, we'll just jump right in. We're in Isaiah chapter 44 is where we will start. But before we start reading in there, I figured we'd start in the book of Genesis, because if Ben's going to cover, you know, three chapters next week, I can start in Genesis and see how far we get. No, but in the very beginning, in Genesis chapter 1, we see God create, right? We see God creates heavens and the earth. We see that he creates the plants, animals. Then he creates you and I. He creates people. And it's this beautiful thing. God creates everything, and it's beautiful. God creates us. But the problem is, just shortly after that, shortly after the creation of man, sin enters into the world, and then we start to get it backwards. Okay, so instead of us worshiping the God that created us, as it should be, we start to create our own gods so that we can be worshipped, so that we can get what we want for ourselves. We place those things above God, whether they be physical or just kind of the idyllic things in our minds. We put those things in the place of God, ultimately making an idol out of those things, and many times out of ourselves. So our topic for tonight is idolatry. I'm talking about idolatry. And the problem is that idolatry can be really subtle. Okay, it's not so clear as the people who are carving statues and, you know, getting their little statues ready to bow down and worship to. It can be a subtle thing. It's not that simple. So what I want to do to start with is have kind of a working definition of idolatry. And the reason for that is so that we don't read in Isaiah and then once we get to Acts and think, yeah, those people, they really had a problem with idolatry. They were really following, seeking, trusting in idols. What I want us to see when we have this definition is that it isn't just God's people back then, but it's a problem today. America 2023. And if we're not careful, believers, Campus Church here at UW-Stout could become a church full of idols, a church full of people seeking after idols. So this working definition. In order to identify the problem, what is an idol? Well, it's anything or any person that's loved more than God, anything or any person that's wanted more than God, desired, anything that we treasure more than God, anything that we're finding hope in more than God, anything that we're trusting in more than God, anything, any person that takes that place that God should have. For you, it might be a girlfriend, boyfriend, might be husband and wife. For many students, it's good grades. If I could just get the right grades, if I could just get done with these classes next week and at least pass my finals. It doesn't even need to be good grades, just passing grades. For some people, it's the approval of other people, right? You want everyone to like you. You want everyone to think well of you. It might be success in business. Some sort of achievement financially. For a lot of people, it's sexual stimulation. That's what they're trusting in. Could be anything. Might be a hobby. It might be a political system. Martin Luther once said, whatever your heart clings to, whatever it confides in, that is really your God. That is your functional savior. Then another quote by John Calvin, he famously said, you've probably heard this, that the human heart is an idol factory. So that idea is that you and I, we're churning out idols. We're making idols for ourselves like a conveyor belt in some sort of manufacturing plant. The idea is we're really good at this. We can make idols out of everything. We can make idols out of anything, and they're all around us. One author says this about the prevalence of idols. Our world is full of viral idols gushing out of fallen hearts, and they flood every nook and cranny in our culture. Okay, so the idea is clear. Idols are all around us. The idea is clear. Anything can easily become an idol. And I hope that you can see that. I hope that you can understand that. I hope that you can see it beyond just being able to identify it for other people, right? Oh, yeah, those people are terrible. They're not putting God first. I hope you can see where you yourselves are tempted to not put God first. Right? You might think, if only I had this boyfriend or this girlfriend, if only I was married to this person, if only our relationship could be like this good, if it could be a little bit better, then I would be satisfied. Then I would be fulfilled. Or you might start to think that you're safe, that you're secure because of the job that you have, right? You got a good job, so you're safe, you're secure. You've got some money in the bank, so you're safe. You've got a good insurance policy now, so you're safe. You start to think, if only the correct political candidate would come, if only they would take over, then everything would be made right. And what we're going to see tonight, and really all throughout the pages of Scripture, it's as if God is screaming at us, no. Like, those things, they're not going to cut it. Those things, they need to fall in their place. They need to fall in line. They're not what you think that they are. You're not going to be fulfilled because you have the right boyfriend and girlfriend. God says, no, I'll fulfill you. You're not going to be safe, secure, because of the money in your bank account, because of the job that you have. Those things might be here today and they'll be gone tomorrow. But God says, I could actually save you. If you let me, I could give you security like you've never had. Everything's not going to be made right because the correct political candidate comes. God says, everything's going to be made right when I come. I think you understand that God's not okay with this, right? God's not okay with idolatry. Not at all. It's one of the Ten Commandments. In fact, if I'm remembering correct, it's the first one. Exodus 20, verse 3, have no other gods before me. Nothing gets to be put before me. Okay? God doesn't share his spot. He doesn't share his glory. The Bible says that he's a jealous God, that he is to be firmly in his place as God, with nothing ever superseding or supplanting him from that spot. God actually warns us in Colossians chapter 3 that we really better get this idolatry problem under control. Colossians chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, it says, therefore, put to death your members, which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. It says, because of these things, the wrath of God is coming. Because of these things, God's wrath is coming. So God says this, if this idolatry isn't worked out, if you don't deal with this, my wrath is coming for you. And yet here the world is, and here so often you and I are just continuing on in it like it's no big deal. And God tries to get our attention very clearly in Isaiah chapter 44. We're going to start in verse 9. Okay, Isaiah 44, starting in verse 9, it says, those who make an image, all of them are useless, and their precious things they shall not profit. They are their own witnesses. They neither see nor know, that they may be ashamed. Who would form a god or mold an image that profits him nothing? Twice in these two verses, we see that idols will profit nothing, that they're not going to satisfy, that they're only going to disappoint. And if any of you are like me and you've wasted some of your life chasing after these things, you can attest to that. Okay, not only because you seek after them and you never actually grab them, you never actually achieve them, you never actually get what it is that you think is going to satisfy you, but even if you do, even if you somehow do lay hands on it and you grasp it, you find that it's not what you expected. It doesn't fulfill, it doesn't satisfy, it doesn't give you everything that you want. No, even if it's good, it doesn't do what you're looking for. Doesn't provide what you really need. But notice that in these verses, it doesn't just stop there. It doesn't just say that the idols are nothing, right? The idols are useless, they're pointless, they're nothing. It says that those who make them are nothing. Okay, it's not just the idols themselves, but so are those who make them. It says all of them are useless. In the words all, it's kind of all-encompassing, this kind of all-sweeping assertion that everyone that makes idols, everyone that places anything in the position that God should be in is useless, is insignificant. How insulting is that? God says, if you put something in the place that I should be, you're useless. insignificant. But that's what God says. You chase after an idol. He says you're an insignificant nobody. The word is useless. You have an idol, God says you're useless. Good for nothing. Doesn't matter how successful you are. Doesn't matter how well-liked you are, how much notoriety you achieve. God says that if you chase after an idol, you're nothing. Harsh words. Psalm 115, verses 4 through 8 says, their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths, but they do not speak, eyes, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear. They have noses, but they do not smell. They have hands, but they do not feel. They have feet, but they do not walk. And they do not make a sound in their throat. Okay, sounds pretty useless, right? A nose that doesn't smell is useless. Eyes that don't see are useless. Hands that can't feel are useless. Nothing, pointless. But then it goes on. It says, those who make them become like them. God says, those who make them become like them. Then the next line is, so do all who trust in them. So do all who trust in them. So in other words, these idols, these images, they misrepresent the nature of God. They don't actually satisfy God, but they also destroy our own nature. Okay, they turn human beings, those who are making them, those who are trusting in them, into, like them, powerless, mindless, thoughtless clumps of unspiritual flesh. We become like those statues. So the nothingness of those idols, the nothingness of those idols make the human beings that trust in them nothing. Nothing. Then back in Isaiah verse 10, we get this rhetorical question. It says, who would do that? Who would make these things? Who would trust in these things? Who would think that they can find satisfaction somewhere other than God? You get the idea of, like, who would be so stupid to do this? That's what's being asked. Who would be so stupid? And you know, the obvious answer should be, well, no one. Well, no one could be that dumb, right? Oh, if only that were the case. I mean, if we had to raise our hands right here, who would do this? I'm putting my hand up. I do this. You do this. So who would be so foolish? You would. You would. Tomorrow, probably. If you're honest. Tomorrow we will. And Isaiah says they are their own witnesses, right? Because they're the ones who made them. So they know how pointless it is because they're the ones that made the stupid statues in the first place. Likewise, you and I are our own witnesses because we're the ones seeking after things that we know, if we're honest, will not give us what we need. They will not satisfy. They will not answer the real questions that we have. We are our own witnesses. Go on, verse 11. It says, surely all of his companions would be ashamed. And the workmen, they are mere men. Let them all be gathered together. Let them stand up, yet they shall fear. They shall be ashamed together. Okay, so in this verse, notice what these idolatrous people have to look forward to. What do they have to look forward to according to these verses? Fear and shame. Fear and shame. And again, being someone who has sadly wasted their life at times, chasing after idols, I can tell you there was a lot of fear and a lot of shame. Fear because I never could grab what it was that I thought I wanted. Fear because it was never enough, even when I got what I was working for, even when I got what I was striving for my whole life, it didn't do anything for me. And then shame because all the while when I was chasing after these idols, they're my consciences trying to pry my hands from these idols and point me back to God. So that's what you have to look forward to. You want to trust in something other than God. You want to chase after something other than God. You want to devote your life to anything other than God. And it will be full of fear and shame. Verse 12. We get this kind of beautiful imagery. Verses 12 to 17. It says, the blacksmith with the tongs works one in the coals. He fashions it with hammers and works it with the strength of his arms. Even so, he is hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and he is faint. The craftsman stretches out his rule. He marks it out with the chalk. He fashions it with a plane. He marks it out with the compass and he makes it like a figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. He cuts down cedars for himself and he takes the cypress and the oak. He secures it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a pine, and the rain nourishes it. Then it shall be for a man to burn, for he will take some of it and warm himself. Yes, indeed, he kindles it and bakes bread. Indeed, he makes a god, and he worships it. He makes it a carved image and falls down to it. He burns half of it in the fire. With this half he eats meat. He roasts a roast and is satisfied. He even warms himself and says, "Ah, I am warm. I have seen the fire." And the rest of it he makes into a god, his carved image. He falls down before it and worships it, prays to it, and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." So here we have this picture. We're led into the workshop of an idol maker, a god maker. Go into his workshop, and the first picture here is that of a blacksmith. And it's impossible, it's absolutely impossible when you read this to not understand the sarcastic tone that it's being written in. Okay? God, through Isaiah here, is illustrating the complete folly, the complete futility, the absurdity of chasing after these things. So the first idol, it's made out of metal. So it's a metal worker. You get this picture of a blacksmith in a shop. Okay, we've all watched the YouTube videos. There's a guy, he takes a piece of metal, he puts it in a forge, it starts to glow, I'm sure, once it gets to a certain temperature. Then they pull it out and they start hitting it with an anvil, and because they know what they're doing, they then put it back in the forge, and right? You know how this works. At least we pretend like we know how this works. Okay, so there he is, pounding away on the anvil, and the thing is, you know, getting worked into the shape that it is, but there's a problem. There's a problem. Okay? He's starting to get sweaty. He's getting dehydrated. He's getting tired. Okay? He forgot to have his electrolytes that morning. Forgot to drink any water. He's getting weaker as he works. He's getting weaker as he works. And that's kind of an important aspect here. He's getting weaker. He's the one who's supposed to be making a god, and yet he's getting tired. He's getting hungry. Right? He forgets to have a lunch. He gets hungry, so he's got to take a break and go and make a sandwich. So imagine this. Your God is that dependent upon you that when you need to have a break to go have lunch, you know, your God just has to stop being formed. Ridiculous, right? And yet, what is it you're trusting in? Whenever you're not working on it, it probably has to be set aside till you can get back to it, till you've went and made your sandwich, till you've been able to sleep and get your rest. So, and what a contrast this is from the real God. In Isaiah chapter 40, so just a couple chapters earlier, we're told that God never gets weary, that he doesn't ever get tired, that God is like a raging fire, that it can ignite infinite number of logs or trees and burn them to ashes, and that he doesn't get diminished at all. And yet here's this God maker, and he gets weary as he goes. So at the end of the day, you can kind of picture, you know, he wipes the sweat from his brow, takes his tongs, and sets his God to the side, and he's proud of himself. It's like, ah, I made a good God today. That doesn't sound like a God I want to trust in. And yet that's the nature of idols. So in Duluth, the noise we have to compete with is sirens. It's a totally different thing. Lots of sirens around our church. So after this picture of the blacksmith, we see a carpenter, right? There's a carpenter. We're led into a wood shop, and we see different techniques. We see different tools, but the same thing that's is happening. Okay, he's working with wood instead of metal, but he's making a god. He seems to be a skilled craftsman. Notice the effort that he puts into, like, getting the correct wood. He goes and he gets cypress and cedar and oak, okay? It's a hard worker, puts in a lot of work. He chisels away at a block until the figure of a man appears. Then it says he uses some wood to burn as a fire to keep warm, some wood to cook on, and some wood to make a god to worship. So we're kind of given this question. How can half of the wood, right? Isaiah gives us this question. How can half of the wood be good for cooking on? Half of it can be a fire, and the other half is a god that can be worshipped. So don't miss the tone. Again, this is absolutely absurd. And so are the things that you trust in. So are the things that tomorrow are going to get priority in your life over the God of the universe? It's no more absurd. It's absurd that we would turn to whatever it is that we turn to instead of the God of the universe. And I love how in here it says that he plants a tree, and it says that the rain nourishes it. The rain nourishes it. Okay? So God's still in control. God's saying, I give life to everything, and yet says that this craftsman is blind to it. Blind to it. So up comes this tree, plants a tree. Then after some decades, right, this is going to take some time. It gets big enough that he's like, oh, that'll make a good God. I'm going to chop this thing down. Now imagine this. Imagine you're in this situation. You cut down your tree, and you're going to go and make a God for yourself. How big do you make it? Small enough to put in your pocket, carry it with you everywhere you go. Huge, because if it's going to be a God, after all, it should be something significant. How big? How big is enough? I don't know. How much money do you need in your bank account? How much of an insurance policy do you need to take out? How many adventures will actually satisfy you? How many sexual experiences do you need to engage in? I guess if it's up to us, we're making our own gods, we get to decide for yourself. You can decide for yourself. But the problem is, it won't be enough, okay? They can go cut down the largest tree. I didn't do any Googling, but back when I cared about such things, I think the General Sherman was like the largest tree. Is anyone here an expert on trees? Okay, we're going to go with that. Sasha's nodding, and I think she's real smart when it comes to trees. Okay, so imagine this. You cut down the biggest tree in the world, and you make a god out of it. It's still not going to be big enough. Still won't satisfy. Just like no matter how much money you have in the bank, no matter how many experiences you have, it's never going to be enough. Never, no matter what. Now, one more thing to think about before we kind of leave this picture. Imagine that this guy, you know, he's working in his shop. Imagine that he has a helper. He's got an apprentice, kind of a guy in training who comes into his wood shop. And what do? They clean up your mess. That's what the helpers do. So here you only got your god halfway done. Just halfway done, it just looks like a carved mess. And the helper didn't realize that. He had no clue. So he's cleaning up, burning the scraps, and he takes your god that you made and throws it in the fire. Throws it in the fire. And you, of course, aren't too happy about that. So you run in, you grab it, you pat the flames out, and you start yelling at him. Well, how was he to know? Because what was the difference between this mess of wood and any other? Well, the only difference is that the carved god took some of this skilled craftsman, his ingenuity, his hard work, his own skill. Maybe he had some training. Okay, you see my point here? We all too often are our own god. We thrust ourselves into the position of God. We make an idol out of what we have to offer ourselves. So what's really being worshipped with that statue? Well, if the one log was good for cooking on, it's not the log, it's the work that he did. And we think somehow we're going to save ourselves, we're going to satisfy ourselves, that somehow we can be trusted. Moving on, verse 18. It says, they do not know nor understand, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I've burned half of it in the fire. Yes, I have also baked bread on its coals. I have roasted meat and eaten it, and I shall make the rest of it an abomination. Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes, a deceived heart has turned him aside, and he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? So in verses 18 to 20 here, God just more clearly exposes this mindlessness of idolatry, the absurdity. It says they know nothing, they don't understand, you know, their eyes are closed, they're so covered over that they can't see what's happening. And we don't really know clearly here, who's being talked about? Is it the statue, the idol itself, or the idolater? I'd say both. I'd say both. The idolater is blind to the foolishness that they're steeped in. Okay, when you get to the point that you're so trusting in anything other than God, you're blind, you're deceived, you're clueless. And that's the essence of idolatry. The essence of idolatry is a deluded heart, deceived heart that misleads us, that thinks something other than God can be trusted for what only God has to offer. It says that they're eating ash. They're eating ashes. Okay, he feeds on ashes. I don't know if any of you have ever ate ash. Maybe you've been, you know, cooking over a fire and some gets on your brat. It's not a big deal. Depending on who you are, you might just eat it boldly. Some of you brush it off. Those of you who are a little more squeamish, like run it underwater and then cook it some more. So I've never like just taken it by the spoonful. So this is just speculation here. But I'm guessing that it's not super satisfying, okay? I'm guessing it's not really nourishing. I can't imagine that it actually gives you the life-giving sustenance that is needed. Just a guess. But it's not a surprise. If you chase after idols, you find that it doesn't actually give you what you needed. It doesn't actually satisfy. It doesn't actually nourish. You don't get the salvation that you were looking for. You don't get the purpose that God can provide. You don't get the security that can only be found in Him. You don't get the life that He has to offer. Okay, so what we gather from this passage is that idols abound. They're all over. This is a huge problem, and it's dumb. God says, this is stupid. This is stupid. Now we're going to look at Acts chapter 17. So flip to Acts 17. If you want to save some time later, you can keep a finger in Isaiah 44. But in Acts 17, there's a well-known passage, very common, and there's a lot that could be gathered from this, a lot that we could glean from it. But I just want to focus on the topic of idolatry. There's a couple things about idolatry here that you'll see are related. Here, Paul, we're switching to the New Testament, Paul is waiting for, I believe, Silas and Timothy. Okay, he's waiting for Silas and Timothy to come back. The idea is kind of Paul's going to do some ministry here in the city of Athens, but he's not going to start it until Silas and Timothy get there. So he's waiting, and what does he do as he's looking around, waiting for them to show up? Well, he doesn't have a phone, so he can't scroll through it, right? That's what we do when we wait. So he's actually observing the world around him. That's what Paul's doing, and I mentioned that partly joking and partly because, let's be honest, if we're talking about idolatry, I think the mention of a cell phone is important. Imagine this. Imagine that tomorrow you leave your house, you leave your dorm room, and you left your phone. You forgot it. And for whatever reason, you can't go back to it, or it's broke. I imagine if you're like the average person, that your whole day is off. You're wondering what you're missing out on. You're kind of stressed. You're constantly checking your pocket and like, oh, it's not there. You're wondering, what should I do? This is a big deal, right? That's what happens. What about when you like miss a day of devotions? What about if you go a whole day without praying to God? Do you realize something's wrong? Probably not. Probably not. Because your phone is your idol. Because evidently for you, going to your phone matters more than going to God. Okay, but anyways, Paul, he didn't have a smartphone. And I would bet even if he did, he wasn't going to use it. So he's actually observing the world, and you know what he notices as he's looking around in the city of Athens? He sees that it is a whole city full of idols, that it's a city of idols. Okay, at one time, the city of Athens was a really impressive city. It was an important city, famous and historic, one of the most glorious and important cities of the world. And you would think he would be there and he'd be impressed with this city. But he's not. He's not impressed with what the city has to offer. Instead, he sees that it's full of idols. And it says that his spirit is provoked. His spirit is provoked. Okay. You can see this in verse 16. Acts 17 and verse 16. So Paul's looking around, he sees all this idol worship, and he's irritated. He's irritated. So we're left with the question, is that your response when you see the pervasiveness of idols all around you? When you look around, is your heart broken because you see so many people chasing after things that you know will not give them what they really need? Are you devastated by it? Are you provoked because you look around and you see that so much glory that is due to God, that God deserves, is instead being misplaced on the most stupid of things? Or do you not care? Do you not care? Is your spirit provoked? Or instead, do you follow with the world's thinking? Think about what the common idols are. Imagine someone you know finally gets the idol that they've worked for their whole life. What's your response? A lot of times, you know what our response is? It's to celebrate along with them, as if this is a great thing and good for them. Shouldn't be the case. Okay, if someone's trusting in something other than God, they finally grab it, you don't celebrate with them. Your heart should be broken that they're so blind, that they don't understand. So what's your response? In verse 18, Paul's response is to confront the idolatry. It says he set out to reason with them. So he goes out to reason with whoever will listen to him, whoever and wherever. Whoever and wherever. Right? Therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentile worshipers and in the marketplace daily with those that happened to be there. So he goes to reason with anyone who will listen. Anyone who will listen. And what's interesting is we notice right away that he gets some pushback. He gets some pushback. Verse 18, it says, "What does this babbler have to say?" What does this babbler have to say? So notice the accusations that come Paul's way. What does this babbler have to say? They accuse him of being a baseless babbler. Okay, the idea of babbler is like, oh, he's not saying anything significant. He doesn't matter. He's pointless. He's nothing. So what's interesting is they accuse Paul of being the exact same thing that God said would be true of them when they're seeking after their idols. God said, if you seek after an idol, you're nothing. And here they are, proving themselves to be nothing. So the question is, who are you going to believe? Are you going to believe God or the adulterous generation around us? Whose words are going to carry the most weight? If you're going to really seek after God, if you're going to really put him first, you'll find that people don't like it, that people will push back. They're going to say, what do you have to say? What are you thinking? What are you doing? This doesn't make sense. Are you embarrassed by that? Do you stop because of that? Or do you believe God? Paul continues his address to the city in verse 22. Verse 22, it says, "Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, 'Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious.'" In all things you are very religious. So I stop at this verse because it's very possible to be religious and adulterous. Okay? Very possible to be both. And you might think, well, yeah, that's obvious. Just think of all the gods that the Hindus worship. Just think of all the gods, the false gods that are out there in false religions. Right? Think of the Muslims. Okay, yeah, that's true. But it's just as possible, just as likely, I would say, to be worshiping idols, all while going to the right, good, Bible-teaching Christian church. In fact, you know what happens is a lot of times you actually turn your attendance and your service and your participation in that church into an idol itself. Okay, so having the right religion, choosing the right religion is no protection against idolatry. Christianity, religious Christianity, is no protection against idolatry. There's plenty of Christians, lots of them, that if you were to kind of peel the veneer of their Christianity back, you pull it apart, look behind there, and you're quickly going to see that it's a form of self-worship, self-trust, self-reliance. So Paul looks around, he sees the city full of idols, and he points it out. He addresses it. And then after exposing the idolatry, seeing this city of idols, Paul provides the only real answer to the problem. Okay, so far, I've talked about just how stupid this is. And how prevalent it is. How dangerous it is. But if we end there, kind of a pointless night. What's the answer? What's the answer to this? Well, Paul provides the only real answer, and that is the magnificence and superiority of the one true God. Let's read in verse 23. It says, "For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you. God, who made the world and everything in it, since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives life, or since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwelling, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him. Though he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live, we move, and we have our being. As also some of your own poets have said, for we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by the art of man's devising." So here Paul speaks about the God who created everything. The God who created everything, yet is very distinct from his creation. Paul told them that God was bigger than any temple that could be made by your and I's hands. Okay, I don't know if you know this, but the work of our hands, anything that you can do, anything that you have to offer God, does not make him any more God than he already is. Right? Our hands can never make God any more God than he already is. And that's in sharp contrast to the gods that they were so familiar with. The temples that Paul was seeing, some of those gods, their priests would actually have to like bring their gods lunch so that they didn't die. Their priests, they'd have to like paint the gods, right? Because they're starting to get a little faded. Their gods fall over and break, so the priests have to fix them up. What kind of God is that? Their God was dependent upon them. Paul says God gives life. He says that all the nations of the earth exist because of God. That the reason we have breath is because of him. That God decided when and where we would be born. He says, because of that, because of who God is, we should seek him and find him. So Paul's answer to idolatry is not to go and tear down all these temples that he saw. Right? He saw all these temples. He was irritated. His spirit was provoked. He knew that this wasn't right. He knew people were trusting in things that could not satisfy. He knew that God was not being given the glory that he deserved. And he didn't go grab the sledgehammer. He didn't go start tearing down the temples. Instead, he pointed to the magnificence and superiority of the one true God. It's been said that if you uproot the idol, so if you uproot any idol in your life, but you fail to plant the love of Christ in its place, an idol's just going to grow back. Okay, he could have gone and tore down the temples and they would have just found some other stupid thing to worship. You can stop seeking your job with your whole heart. But if you don't then seek God with your whole heart, you'll just seek after a spouse instead. So Paul's answer to idolatry here is that Jesus is better. Jesus is better. It's that simple. What's the answer to idolatry? Jesus is better. Way better. Let's see God's answer. Back in Isaiah. Picking it up right where we left off in Isaiah 44. Starting in verse 21. It says, "Remember these, O Jacob and Israel, for you are my servant. I have formed you. You are my servant." God says, remember these things. Remember what I say because you are my servant. He says, I'm not your servant. I don't do your bidding. You do mine. And he says, remember, I made you. I formed you. I made you, and yet you're going to trust in something other than me? It says, O Israel, you will not be forgotten by me. So God says, I will remember you. You're not going to be forgotten by me. The idols that we trust in, the idols that we follow, they're here one day and gone the next. They use us for what they can get and then dispose of us just as quickly. God says, but I'll always remember you. I won't forget you. Your idols will fail, but I'll remember you. He says, I have blotted out like a thick cloud your transgressions and like a cloud your sins. Return to me, for I have redeemed you. So God says, I've actually taken care of the real problem. Okay, any idol that you're chasing after, guess what? They do nothing for your sin. They leave you just as lost, just as stuck in your sin as you were before. God says, I answer the real problem. I wash away your sin. What can your idols do about your sin? They hold no answers. They offer no salvation. Any safety that they promise are just empty promises. God says, I erased your sins. He says, I paid the price. I redeemed you. Return to me. Goes on and says, sing, O heavens, for the Lord has done it. Shout, you lower parts of the earth. Break forth into singing, you mountains. O forests and every tree in it, for the Lord has redeemed Jacob and glorified himself in Israel. So God says, worship me. Don't worship all those other things. Don't worship anything else. Nothing else is worthy of your worship. None of those ridiculous things that you think are going to satisfy you are worthy of your devotion. Don't waste your life giving it to them. But I'm the one worthy of worship. I'm the one that's worth shouting for. I'm the one that's worth singing for. I'm the one that's deserving the glory. What do you shout for? Honestly. Do you shout because of God? Does he get you more excited than anything else? Do you break forth into singing because of God? Or because you had a decent day? Something to consider. And I'll tell you, once you find that you actually know the real God, the God that Scripture reveals, you find that he's worth singing for. He's worth shouting for. And I say that as someone who never once sang in front of anyone until I knew God. He's worth it. I shout now. I mean, this is me shouting. It's not that much of a shout. But for me, I shout because God's worth shouting for. I didn't shout about anything else. The dumb stuff that I chased after before. He goes on and says, thus says the Lord your Redeemer, and he who formed you from the womb. I am the Lord who makes all things, who stretches out the heavens all alone, who spreads abroad the earth by myself. So he reminds us again that he saved us, that he saved us, he redeemed us, he is our Redeemer. That he made us, but he didn't just make us, that he created the world, stretched out the heavens, spread abroad the earth. And he says that he did it by himself. How many of you have ever put together like an IKEA shelf? And you get like halfway through and you realize, I gotta wait till my roommate gets home. I can't do this. God says, I made the world and I did it alone. Like I didn't need your help. God wasn't, you know, waiting for his roommate to get home to be able to make the Atlantic Ocean. He says, I did this all alone. It's pretty impressive. Pretty impressive. He says, there's no one like me. No one can do what I can do. No one has the answers that I have. He says, I stand alone. It's nothing like this. Goes on and says, who frustrates the signs of the babblers and drives diviners mad, who turns wise men backward and makes their knowledge foolishness. So often we look to the wisdom of the world. We think that the world has the answers, right? Enough science, enough research, enough study, and we're going to figure everything out and everything's going to be okay and we're going to solve the problems. God says, my understanding is so far beyond what the best that this world has to offer that it's incomparable. You know, throughout the most intelligent people you can know of, God says, they're nothing to me. Nothing to me. He says, I make the wise foolish. I'm so far beyond them, it's incomparable. I don't know if you know this, but secular scientists, they spend like billions of dollars, and millions of man hours to only fail at providing answers to questions that God gave us thousands of years ago. God's like, you're really going to spend billions of dollars trying to figure this out? You could just pick up a Bible. God's made it so clear. He goes on and says, who confirms the words of his servant, performs the counsel of his messengers, who says to Jerusalem, you shall be inhabited, to the cities of Judah you shall be built, and I will rise up her waste places. Who says to the deep, be dry, I will dry up your rivers. Who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, he shall perform all my pleasure. Saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built, and the temple, your foundation shall be laid. Okay, there's a lot of history here. A lot of things that you could get kind of lost in, but don't get lost in the history. Don't get lost in the specifics of all of these. We could look at those if we had more time. But what God is saying is, what I say is going to happen, what I promise, it's actually going to happen. He says, I stand by my decrees. What I promise, when I say that a river is going to dry up, when I part the Red Sea, it actually happens. I don't make empty promises that could never fulfill. That's those other stupid things you trust in. They make all kinds of empty promises, and they don't come through. I make promises, and every one of them comes true. He foils the signs of false prophets, makes fools of diviners, overthrows the learning of the wise, turns it into nonsense, carries out the words of his servants, fulfills the predictions of his prophets, like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hosea, anyone you want to read about in here, the true prophets, the true promises, God fulfills what they said, but the false prophets go away. So what God's saying here, what God's trying to make clear, and what I hope we'll remember from this, is I'm better in every way. I'm better in every way. The boyfriend that you're hoping for, the girlfriend that you're hoping for, the job that you're working your whole life for. I mean, some of you, you have been working your whole life to get a job. God says, don't put so much stock in that. Don't put so much stock in that. I am better in every way. Why would you not trust me? Why would you not listen to me? I know what I'm doing. And yet, like I said, tomorrow, you'll probably be an idolater. If I'm honest. I can tell you, as someone who's now starting to rack up the sermons that I've preached, what's really irritating is I don't know if they do any good. I don't know if they do any good. Are we going to remember that God's actually better? Sure, now we are. What about when the decision time comes? Where you can put God first, or you can chase after something else that you think is going to really make you happy. If we're not worshiping the one true God, we're worshiping some fabrication, some imitation, some deception of a God that we've made for ourselves, that we've made for ourselves. And don't just assume that because you say that you're worshiping the God of Christianity, that it's actually the God of Scripture. Okay? We need to figure out who God is according to his word, not according to what we think. And if that's you, you're worshiping anything other than God, it's as if God's screaming from these pages of Scripture tonight, I'm God. I'm God. There's no one other. There's no one else like me. There's no one else worth trusting. I am the God who made the whole universe. I made you. I know what I'm doing. I have the answers you're looking for. Not only do I have the answers that you're looking for, I am the answer that you're looking for. Anything else is empty, hollow, disappointing, hopeless, pitiful. God says, there's no one like me. Psalm 96, verse 5, for all the gods of the people are worthless idols. All the gods of the people are worthless idols. But the Lord, he made the heavens. When I think of idolatry, I always think of the game King of the Hill. Maybe more accurately for the topic tonight, we'll say God of the Hill. Now, the dangerous thing is when you talk about a game like that to a group like this, campus church, if you're older than me, you were able to like boldly play King of the Hill on the playground and like not get in trouble. You didn't have to do it in secret at all. Maybe. And then if you're like my age, you kind of got to play King of the Hill, but you had to do it secretly when no one was looking, when the teacher had their back turned. And I'm guessing if you're younger than me, it's like you weren't allowed to do that at all. But it's a really complicated game. There's a lot of rules where you get to the top of the hill at any cost. You bite, shove, kick, whatever, to keep anything else from supplanting your preeminence at the top of the hill, because you're most important. And that's what I think about when I think of idolatry. There we are, fighting our way to the top. There we are, shoving things up to the top as if in doing so, like as if us getting to the top, we win. Like, yeah, I made it. I'm going to win now. And God's just standing there. Like, he's not fighting. He's just standing there looking at you like, I'm ready to take my spot if you'll let me. And we think we're shoving him down. There he is, just waiting for us to get out of the way. If you want to be the king of your own life, you want to make your own decisions, you want to put yourself as preeminent or anything else, God will let you do it. He will. You want to thrust anything else up to that top position instead of God, that's your prerogative. But I can say that I've found that as for me, I don't want that spot. That spot is God's. And I would do well to remember it. You guys would do well to remember it. I'll end by mentioning John chapter 6. In John chapter 6, Jesus says some hard things and a ton of people leave him. Okay? It says that a lot of his followers left him to follow him no more. And then Jesus turns to his disciples, to his core group. He says, are you guys going to leave me too? You guys going to leave me too? Peter's response is, well, no. No, because you're all there is. You have what I need. Do we remember that? Do we really remember that? Does your life prove that that is true? That Jesus has what you need and nothing else does?